Well, thanks for the kind introduction and the invitation and giving me the opportunity to present my ideas. So this talk is going to be about a different kind of information that is written into DNA molecules, not the classical genetic information, the genes that encode for proteins, but mechanical information. So the claim is that in the base pair sequence, there are mechanical cues that tell, for instance, the DNA how to fold inside the cell. And what makes it especially interesting is, and I will show you that, that you can multiplex these two types of information, the classical genetic information and the mechanical information, as you can have two phone conversations on the same wire. And because that is the case, I imagine that the DNA molecule evolves mechanically, sort of parallel to the classical evolution, and what comes out of this evolution is what I call a mechanical genome. And as you see, I use already words that have to do with evolution, but my understanding of evolution is not beyond Richard Dawkins, so I'm here to learn. I'm happy for interruptions, criticism, ideas, to learn what I can do about this kind of work. I said that the mechanical genome helps the DNA to fold inside the cell, and I have to be more concrete, and I will speak here about eukaryotes. In eukaryotes, as I imagine you all know, DNA is hierarchically folded with the help of proteins into the chromatin complex. And the first level of this compaction is the one which I will speak about, where the DNA double helix is wrapped around protein cylinders, forming a series of DNA spools that are also, the repeating units are also called nucleosomes. And so, that is the first level, and then there are higher levels of compaction up to the whole chromosome. However, these are highly debated in the literature, and I will not today speak about it. So I will only focus on nucleosomes. Now we know a lot about nucleosomes. We know the nucleosome in exquisite detail from X-ray diffraction, and so this is just the wrapped part of the DNA around the protein cylinder. It's also called the nucleosome core particle, in which 1/3 of DNA are tightly wrapped around an octamer of histone proteins. That's the top view and the side view. And the number of DNA base pairs that are wrapped is 147 base pairs. That number will pop up soon. And what forces the DNA away from its preferred straight state are interactions that are localized at 14 binding patches between the backbone of the DNA molecule and some patches on the surface of the cylinder. Now you see that DNA is very tightly wrapped here, and that means that you can imagine that small mechanical differences in the elasticity, let's say, of the DNA molecule can make a big difference with respect to the affinity of the protein cylinder to that sequence.
Can you talk about 14 binding sites? This is the 14 points where the histones bind to the DNA?
Yeah, yes. So, in fact, it's where the minor groove of the DNA faces the surface of a protein cylinder. It's always at least at each of the backbones is one phosphate strongly bound. You can see this when you look at the B factor, it's much smaller at these places. And so this could suggest that in the DNA molecule could be written some kind of code that tells nucleosomes where to be, and that might be important for instance, which DNA is easy to access and which not, so it can have important implications for the expression of genes and so forth. Now, these are not new ideas. I try to go back in time and see where it popped up the first time. This seems to be the oldest reference I could come up with. It's from Andrew Draver's lab at Cambridge. And he observed already that there are certain rules, that certain DNA sequences like to wrap into nucleosomes or form very stable nucleosomes. The way he did this is he extracted chicken erythrocyte chromatin. He added an enzyme, micrococcal nuclease, that digests the DNA. And only the very stably wrapped DNA stretches would survive this procedure. About 100 of such sequences were sequenced and then aligned by the middle, and certain statistical features turned to become apparent. So when you look, for instance, so they look typically at base pair steps, one base pair followed by the next base pair. And they found, for instance, when you look at G followed by C, there is a 10 base pair periodic signal of this ensemble of sequences. Sequences like to rep peak at these positions here. And when you look at the crystal structure, these turn out to be positions where the major groove of the DNA faces the surface of the protein cylinder. And then there were other, actually two only in that paper, but later they saw another one, base pair steps, AA, TT, and TA. So it's always A followed by an A, T followed by a T, and so on. And they showed also a 10 base pair periodic signal, which they are all in phase, but out of phase with GC. And when you look at the crystal structure, good sequences that like to wrap have these motifs where the minor groove of the DNA faces the protein cylinder. The late journal, there comes more. And so when you look in the paper, they don't say anything, except at the end of the paper, they say these sequence-dependent features constitute a further kind of information present in the DNA molecule, in addition to its well-known propensity to encode the amino acid sequence of proteins. So that's the oldest place where I found this idea. Now, at that time, the late Jonathan Whittam was a postdoc at this lab, and I imagine that he got interested in this already back then. And 20 years later, after lots of preparation, he came up with a claim in a Nature paper that there is a genomic code for nucleosome positioning, or to use his own words, genomes care where nucleosomes are on average, and so genomes encode explicit information to bias their positions. The way he tried to show this is that he mapped positions of nucleosomes on a genome, made a predictive model from it, and then checked how good it would work on another genome. And he came to the conclusion that a large fraction, or the largest fraction of nucleosomes, is actually positioned by the underlying base pair sequence. But this is a highly debated result still nowadays. Now, after his untimely death in 2011, I decided that I will give it a try and see what I can do as a theoretical physicist about this problem. And I didn't expect that it would happen, but I got completely sucked into the problem and I do not much else at the moment than working on this kind of problem. And what I will tell you today is all work in that direction. It's all not yet published. So how could we access this problem? Well, as a physicist, we like to think in phase spaces and stuff like that, and we might want to do things very exactly. So we might want to just make an exact enumeration of all possible sequences that could be wrapped in a nucleosome, get the energies or whatever, and then we know everything. That would be maybe an idea. How many sequences could be wrapped into a nucleosome? Well, the sequence is 147 base pairs long. There are four different letters, so there are 4 to the 147 different sequences that you could wrap into a nucleosome. If you would make a DNA molecule that would contain all these sequences, it would densely fill 5 Milky Ways. That's how much there is. So this is my sequence space. Now, what do people typically do? Well, one thing that is done very often is to look at concrete genomes. And the one that most people look at in that context is Baker's yeast, which has just 12 million base pairs. And so that means you would only look at the 10 minus 81th fraction of this gigantic space. You can go to human DNA, but it's not much better. The best I know about is an experiment actually performed in 98 by John Whittam, where they started from a large pool of random DNA, 5 trillion sequences. These DNA molecules had about the wrapping lengths. And in this experiment, the idea was to find sequences that like to wrap into nucleosomes. So these 5 trillion sequences had to compete with each other for a limited amount of these protein cylinders. The winners were taken and again enhanced and again had to compete. And after 15 rounds, they found 30 sequences with a very high affinity to nucleosomes. And you might wonder why so few when you start with such a huge pool. Well, the problem is that you have to start up front with some random random sequences. And so only very few will be the ones you're interested in. For instance, imagine that we arrange our sequences in this space such that the highest affinity sequences are in the center of our Milky Way. Then, by pure chance, there will be very few sequences that are actually inside the corner of the galaxies. And in fact, one of these sequences, the winner of them all, is the so-called 601 Widom sequence that is widely used now in experiments because it's very easy to work with it. And I will show you later experiments that use that sequence that was found through this experiment. But now imagine we would do things different. Instead of having to start with a random selection, could we not just take a rocket and fly where we want to go and then look at, let's say, 10 million sequences? And that's what we're going to do. It's a computational approach. It requires a computer representation of the nucleosome. And then through a method that we call mutation Monte Carlo method, we can look easily at 10 million sequences and learn about their properties. And then we can do many more things.
So of course, to make that work, you have to have an energy function that
yes.
seems that map sequence onto
absolutely.
Well
yes. So this method can be used for many different models. And the model that we use now seems to be good enough to get reasonable answers. But we want to use better models in the future and then see how good actually our model is.
A question about the 601. So those are the strongest binders?
That is the sequence that has the highest affinity to the octamer compared to any other sequence. The strongest natural sequence is a 5S RNA from sea urchin, and that's about 5 KT worse.
Okay, that was my question.
Yeah.
How do those strongest binders in vitro correspond to things that you actually
yes.
know?
So, as I said, they're a bit better. But I believe from our work, which is still using just a model, that the numbers will be much more dramatic if you take much better sequences. I could imagine that it could be 20 KT better than the best sequences.
Do you have some sort of
better.
Plot? Oh, sorry,
better means stronger binding?
Yes.
I guess I'm wondering if in vivo it actually is the absolute strongest binders that are used by cells.
So the strongest binders are not used by nature. I'll come back to that. No.
I was going to ask whether you have a graph of the energy distribution function for the different sequences. So
yes, I have it, but not
like
in this talk.
But like, what's the difference between the best one and say the worst one versus the median one, and,
yeah.
and what do they look like along that?
It's a very
curve.
Wide distribution, so the energy goes up and down with a 10 base pair periodicity.
What I'm asking is...
And so that's a very wide distribution of, I don't know, 15 KT.
If you take a trillion sequences
yes.
that are just random and plot like the best versus the worst one, and
yeah.
what does that look like in terms of the difference in energy, say, for the best binder versus the worst binder?
And, yeah. I don't have the numbers exactly in my head, but they are very big, like 40 KT or something.
I will actually show
a plot later
okay.
that you can look at. But you could say that the distribution sort of looks like this of the energies, right?
Right.
I don't know if you can see anything.
You could just switch right to the rate.
Right, thank you. And that is for real genomes. And if you, for a real genome, let's say. And if you do random DNA, actually, it looks more like this. There is a difference.
Axes on your plot.
This is the probability to find like a histogram of energy as a function of energy for the nucleosomes as you pull them along the sequence, push them over the sequence.
Positive is stronger. Positive is stronger or less strong.
Yeah, I have
positive
to be careful
is.
what I'm putting here actually. So it turns out that the So I should say that these are the this is the these are genomic the genomic distribution which is actually no wrong this is a genomic distribution that has typically higher energies than a random sequence, which seems to indicate that there is some evolution going on to expel nucleosomes from certain regions.
So positive is less strong.
This would be less strong because it's more expensive. That's a cost of, sorry, I'm not clear here. That's a cost of wrapping DNA around the nucleosome.
The selection against strong binding to the nucleosome.
Yeah, you could say that. Even though there are certainly some sequences, some places where there is a strong binding. But this is stuff which I'm just starting to work with, because the methods that I'm going to use now is much too slow to do this. We have now a new method that's a million times faster where we can start to do these things. But this is just the beginning. I don't want to say much about it.
Yes? So this in vitro experiment, do you question whether it's representative of what happens in vivo, or that's all you have?
So as a physicist, I'm going much smaller, slower steps than biologists. I have to understand each little step first. And the first step that I want to understand is, can I understand the rules that are seen in vitro with my model? And when the answer is yes, then I can do the next step. And so I'm going really much slower than, well, thank you. That's typically done in that field.
Just one more question.
Yes.
So who's the nucleus cells being wrapped here? Is it surface here?
Sorry?
There is some variation in the histone sequences.
Yes, there are some variations. So I'm not looking into that at this point. Histones are very well conserved in evolution, but they're different variants, and they have some functions in certain places. You have a certain variant popping up, maybe at the transcription start site or such things. I'm not looking at that. So I will show you now soon. I mean, I'm just starting from a normal nucleosome crystal structure. Yes, sort of. This is stuff I can do in the future, step by step. So let me show you, because you will understand what I can do at this point soon. So what are questions that I want to ask? So the first one is actually, are these positioning rules that I just showed you mechanical in nature? Is it the DNA mechanics that causes them? Or is it maybe specific interactions between some nucleotides and residues on this amino acid that cause these rules? And so I will check whether with a purely mechanical model I can find these rules again. And the answer will be yes. And because of that, I can go a step further and then explicitly show that you can multiplex classical and mechanical information, classical and mechanical genetic information. So, as Rob already pointed out, I need a model. And so the model that I'm using is a very well-established DNA model, a very coarse-grained model, where you describe the conformation of a DNA molecule. It will be the DNA molecule that's wrapped into a nucleosome, just by the conformations and orientations, locations and orientations of the base pairs that are modeled as rigid plates, if you want so. And then there are 6 degrees of freedom, 3 translational one and 3 rotational one, with which you can, per base pair step, with which you can describe the conformation of the DNA molecule. If you just want to make standard B-DNA, all you have to do is you have a finite rise and a finite twist. All the rest can be zero. And you get a twisted stack of base pairs, which looks pretty much like the structure of B-DNA. And I can here also note that the backbones are attached on one long side of the base pairs. That is shown here in orange. And so as a result, there will be a minor groove between these backbones on this side and a major groove on the other side going around the DNA molecule. So this is the major groove between these two backbones, a minor groove here, and here's a major groove. Now, inside the nucleosome, DNA is bent. And this can be achieved by using other degrees of freedom. And for simplicity, I'm only discussing here the roll, which is a rotation around the long axis of base pairs. So by periodically varying the roll between positive and negative values with the DNA helical repeat, you actually make a bent stack of base pairs. And so we can now actually reformulate these rules that I introduced earlier, namely GC, or DNA sequences that like to wrap into nucleosomes have a GC at positions where the role is positive. That means you close towards the major groove, and AATT and TA half peak at positions where the minor groove has its most negative value, or you're close towards the minor groove. But this is just geometry. We still need energy to check whether these things make sense. And luckily, this model has been parameterized by a whole consortium of groups over more than 10 years. One has figured out the energies associated with these deformations. This is one of the very few, I think, two formulas in my talk. So a given conformation of a base pair step can be described by the values of these 6 degrees of freedom. And you just have, for a given base pair step, a certain preferred values, the intrinsic values of that step, which I put in the vector x0. So x minus x0, that is a deviation from the preferred conformation. And all I say, that's what we always do in physics, it's not great, but the best we can do at this point, is that the energy is quadratic in deviations from that preferred value. So this is a 6x6 matrix that contains all the stiffnesses of these degrees of freedom. And as I said, these have all been parameterized. For each individual type of base pair step, we have values for those. They were extracted from experiments by looking at protein DNA co-crystals or from all-atom molecular dynamics simulations by many groups over many time, where you really you simulate all the atoms and the solvent and the ions and so forth. We just use these values. So let's make a first sanity check.
So how much, besides those values, what are you putting in my hand?
So these values have been found by people through simulations.
But besides this, what else are you putting in by hand? That is,
in my model?
Yeah, are you putting in the GC?
I will not put anything in the model, no free parameters in the end. So I have ways of doing everything without free parameters.
Not even the 10 base pair?
I don't put anything in, no, okay. Zero.
Well, just to follow up on that point,
yeah.
I think what he does, he takes any sequence,
yep,
and you can get energy. And so an AA or a CA or whatever,
right,
shows.
Of course, I have to put now the nucleosome into the DNA into the conformation in which it's found in the nucleosome. That comes in a second.
Do you take into account parameters like distances between strand to strand, like buckles and other?
No, I don't put anything like this in. So I only put in this degree of freedom. The base. Yeah. So yes. So for instance, I don't take into account base in a base pair step degrees of freedom. We plan to do this as a next step because just now people have managed to parameterize a better model that is more fine-grained. But this is the first one that we have so far. So I'll come back to this in a second, right? So, and let's just check whether this model makes sense. And so I showed you that good sequences that like to wrap have G followed by a C at positive roll positions. So let's check whether the parametrization that people gave us have that property. We would expect that GC. So here I plot for all independent base pair steps, the roll stiffness versus the preferred intrinsic roll. And I would expect GC to be in the lower right corner because that would be a position where you have positive roll already intrinsically, and it would be a very soft step. So GC should be somewhere here if this model should make sense. But it's here. So it seems not to work. But it will turn out not to be a problem. It's just that you cannot think so simple about the problem, right? So GC seems to peak at position where it hates to be. That's strange. So now we have to do something, really, and so here's our model. So we take this DNA model that I just introduced to you, and we force this stack of base pairs into the conformation in which it's found in crystal structures. And we do this by putting, at certain places, constraints on the DNA molecule. The places where we put the constraints, we find in the crystal structure. We just look where are the B factors very low, so where is the DNA confined. So we do everything without free parameters. We cannot make the result be better or something. It just comes out what comes out. So that's all. We don't model at all the protein cylinder. It's just there implicitly by these binding sites. And we assume that's not perfect, but we cannot do much better at this point, that these binding sites are infinitely strong. There's no degrees of freedom. So now we could take a sequence, like the one that I depict here, which is a 601 sequence, actually, and we could, you know, simulate or measure energies, whatever, of this sequence. But we do a bit more. And this is our rocket.
I thought you told us that the binding sites were every 10 base pairs.
Ah, thank you, yes.
Why are the red dots bouncing around so much if they're every 10?
Yeah, so here, it's here, 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 every 10 base pairs. It's always the backbone, you know, this is a minor groove here. And this is one backbone attached to the surface, and it's the other backbone attached to the surface. So this is one binding site. They do indeed bounce around a lot, because if you actually look at the histone proteins, there are different types of binding sites, sort of three different types of classes. And so they are not all at the same positions or something.
So this is on average 14, or is it exactly 14?
It's exactly 14 binding sites, three per histone protein, which makes 12, and then two at the outside.
So this is one specific sequence.
This is one specific
sequence. You did it with a different sequence.
Yes. Yeah, so we do some tricks here, some dirty tricks, to be honest, but we cannot do it this point better. So we looked at different crystal structures, of course, and we looked where do the binding sites lie at different for different sequences. So we look at different crystal structures with different sequences and looked at the variations of, for instance, these things. There are some variations. We don't account for them. We sort of make a pre-relaxation step where we let, so the positions, they are pretty fixed, but the orientations vary a bit between different crystal structures. And we don't account for them. We simply make a pre-relaxation step where we let the orientation choose the preferred.
You give it choices based on different structures.
Yes, we allow it to relax a little bit. It's not possible at this point to do this better. And we do this with a homogeneous DNA sequence. This is not perfect, but we cannot do at this point better because there's not enough data to properly account for the elasticities of these sites. We have tried that, but it doesn't work well enough.
There are not so many nucleosome structures with different DNA sequences, like RNA-seq-like, RNA sequences, or what else?
Yeah, we looked at, I don't know exactly how many we looked at, but a handful we looked at. You look at one with 147 base pairs on it, not the classical one, which has a twist effect.
Sorry, can you say, this is just a complicated question. So can you just tell me about how this model is different from these other models that you...
Yeah, so there are lots of models that do pretty much the same. So this is a model by ourselves where we try to account for the elasticity, but it means you have to bring in a lot of free parameters. It's not very good. This is a very early paper. These are earlier papers. So in these earlier papers, they don't allow for the relaxation of these sequences. They take just a crystal structure, essentially, or let's say in the first paper, and then they slide a sequence through that leads to extremely high energy variations because you don't relax the system. Other models like these two assume an ideal helix. This one here and this one start from the crystal structure. But the differences between the models are not crucial. I think they get pretty much the same answer. What's crucial is what's on the next slide. And that is that our rocket, our mutation Monte Carlo method. And so what we do now is we simulate our DNA at a finite temperature, which means it wiggles around. And to get to thermal equilibrium, you take a base pair randomly, and you change its conformation a little bit. And then you just look at the change in energy, and you accept or reject the move with the usual metropolis scheme used in these kind of simulations. This means we can move in the conformational space of the DNA molecule. But in parallel, in many of our simulations, we also perform mutations. So we grab a base pair, and we just change its chemical identity. All what this will do is it will change the elastic energy, because the two base pair steps involved, the two base pair steps that change And they're just the energy changes, and we accept and reject the move, again, accordingly with the Metropolis scheme. So we can move in parallel, in sequence, and in conformation space. And this is a very simple idea, but very powerful. So with this, we can, in no time, arrive here, simply by simulating this. It will automatically go to sequences that are happy to be bent into a nucleosome. And then we can easily look at 10 million sequences. And that's what we find. So when we perform this simulation and then look at our 10 million sequences that we produced, we recover the positioning rules, the well-known positioning rules that you see here again, the two types of positioning rules. And maybe most remarkably, we find that the GC steps peak where they should peak according to the experiments. And that is surprising because I told you earlier that in this model, GC hates to be at these positions because this is just the opposite of what where it wants to be. So why does GC peak at its least favorite position on the nucleosome? Well, for this you have to look in more details, and it turns out that the reason is simply that GC brings in good neighbors. A motif like AGCT is very good at this position, simply because AG and CT are good, even though GC itself is not very happy, but it brings in good neighbors. So the rules, you can reproduce the rules, but you have to think a bit about it, why they are like that.
I'm just confused about which are on the same strand and which are on different strands. Is GC a pair across two strands, or is GC two nucleotides on the same strand?
It's a base pair step on the same strand, so a GPC step, right?
It's the same, okay.
Yeah, so yes, so it's a GC step in this direction, a GC step in the other direction.
So the GC are acting to orient the AT in a better position than another motif could do there?
Say again, I didn't understand the question.
What is the GC doing to the AT to make them better than
the AT? Okay. So what happens is that if you have in principle at this position, you could take any base pair step. But once you make a decision, like take a GC at this position, the number of possible steps on the left and possible steps on the right becomes much less.
Because you're trying to make it a realistic dinucleotide composition, like as in cells or something?
No, I don't do anything. I don't put anything in. I don't try to do anything realistic. It just comes out.
So why isn't it TT or AA or something?
It just happens. It happens. I cannot do anything about it. And if you want to understand the rules, you have to go in all the details and think very hard. So it turns out that at this position, a TA likes to be, because it's a very soft step and DNA has to bend a lot. It's like you logically would expect it. But here, it turns out at these positions where the GC peaks, that there is no, a TA would be good at this position because it's very soft. But it would mean that the step before would have to end with a T, and the next step would have to start with an A, and they are just not very good steps that have that property as neighbors.
Can you also clarify what the impact of the binding constraint is? Because you said you had to put in the 14 binding sites. Does that influence the pattern that you get here?
It will influence details of the pattern, but not the general rules. So we have tested a lot of things. We looked also at different parameterization. This is kind of robust. Yes?
Given the huge numbers of sequences you can look at, how accurately can you get this periodicity? Can you get, for instance, down to 5%?
Do you mean this periodicity?
Yes.
This should not be entirely periodic because, do you mean that these all should look the same?
Can you see the difference between 10 base pairs and 10 and a half base pairs? I notice you're almost, the way you're plotting it, you're assuming 10.
I'm assuming 10 simply because this is about the periodicity which is enforced by the constraints onto the DNA. So it's just about 10 base pairs.
Well, I guess my question is about the about. How accurately you're saying you are putting some information in, but that's the 14 binding sites.
Right. So I...
And that comes to 10 and a half, if I did the math right. Right? 147 divided by 14.
Good point. The last binding site is not at the very end. It's a 10 base pair periodicity. So the last dangle sort of freely.
That's actually forced by the binding site position.
Yeah. Yeah. The noises, you say?
Yeah.
I have to sort of let the system explore a certain part of sequence space. I want to go to the in this Milky Way. I want to go in the center, and by putting a certain temperature, I will explore a certain part of this space. If I would increase the noise by making this by performing this simulation at a higher temperature, then these peaks will shrink. If I go to lower temperatures, the peaks will sharpen. And I could, in principle, choose a temperature where the peaks are as high as in the experiment, but different experiments have different peak heights. There's a lot of stuff going on, so there's no need for me to try to do that.
And the green line at the bottom, are you saying that you could see a periodicity study using GC, used AG, CT?
If I would see a periodicity, you. Yeah. If I plot the same plot for AGCT, I would see a very periodic signal. Yes, we did that. Yeah, true.
But not so periodic. It's like TGC.
Right. So AGCT will be very sharp, but if I make a variation of that, then it will be less sharp. Yeah, you can look at tetranucleotides. People have also done this experimentally. But the problem is that at some point you run out of statistics, especially when you look with real genomes. Okay, so the answer to the first question is that yes, we can say that the positioning rules to a large extent are explainable by a purely mechanical model. And I want to show that you can multiplex this mechanical information with genetic information. What that means becomes clear in a second. So what we have to look at now is a gene that encodes for a protein, and then we will try to put on that gene also mechanical information. The gene that we chose is one from Dacas yeast, just randomly picked. It's just a 500 base pair long stretch of that gene, so that's a given sequence that encodes for a protein. And now we just shifted our nucleosome over this energy landscape. So this is always the energy when the middle of the red portion is at that position of the nucleosome. And as you shift the nucleosome over this gene, there are very strong variations in the energy. You see this is 80, this is 60 kT. And they have about a 10 base pair periodicity. Where do they come from? Well, it just happens that any piece of DNA has typically a preferred bending direction, like my arm likes to bend this way. And when you shift the nucleosome further, the DNA has to make a corkscrew rotation on the protein core. And so 5 base pairs further, it will actually be wrapped in the wrong direction. And so the energy goes up, and 5 base pairs further is again wrapped in the right direction. And so that's where these undulations come from. Also shown in this plot are nucleosomes that have been mapped with single base pair resolution in vivo. This is a new method that had been developed by John Widom, but was published only posthumously. And so these are nucleosomes that have been mapped on this yeast. And as you can see, the minima in our model, the local minima, are typically also where the nucleosomes sit. So it's quite clear that the base pair sequence has a strong effect, at least locally, where nucleosomes are. That could be called the rotational positioning or phasing of nucleosomes. So now I can tell you what I mean with multiplexing. What I want to do is I want simply to shift one of these mechanical minimums freely around, sort of take the nucleosome and put it anywhere I like along this gene. That would mean that I can multiplex these two types of information. How could we do that? Well, this is just a piece of this gene. And I cut it now down into the codons. And this codon sequence encodes for this particular sequence of amino acids. But as you all know, the genetic code is degenerate. And in 18 of 20 cases, there's actually more than one way to spell out amino acid. And so here are all the allowed, all the synonymous codons to a given amino acid. So threonine, for instance, can be ACA, ACT, ACG, or ACC, to give an example. So what we can do now is to use a modified version of our mutation Monte Carlo, where we just make synonymous mutations. We switch between different codons. That way, we do not touch the amino acid sequence, but we can change the mechanical properties of the sequence. And so we take now that well-positioned nucleosome that has also been mapped in the experiment, and we ask ourselves, can we shift this minimum freely around? And here's the answer to the question, yes, we can. We can put it anywhere we like. The way we do this is simply we put the nucleosome at the position where we want to create a minimum, like here, and we perform synonymous mutations. And then automatically, a sequence will pop up that will still code for the same protein, but has different mechanical properties as a minimum now at this position.
So your scale there is just the bending of the DNA, right?
Yes.
It's not the attraction of the DNA to the
No system. Attraction inside.
And so how? So that must be a big negative value somehow, which goes on top of that.
Yes, so if you want the real numbers, or if you want the numbers, then you have to think about that there's a very huge bending energy and an even huger adsorption energy. And the two actually nearly cancel. So that in the end, you have about 1 kT gain per binding site, which makes the nucleosome actually a very dynamic and accessible structure.
So doesn't that also have a sequence dependence?
Apparently not enough to matter. I would say no, because the reason is the binding sites are actually where the phosphates of the backbones bind to the surface of the octamers. There are no contacts between residues and nucleotides, and so it's a purely sequence-independent effect.
So if you did your energy optimization thing without the histones being present, you'd get the same answer, that's what you're saying.
If you would have no
structures, this is to do with interactions within the DNA and not to do with interactions between the DNA and the histone.
No, if you would do the same thing without any constraints on the DNA, you would not find this. You would just get a random noise. It's that you force the...
Right, but if you have the curve, I mean, if you have the curve...
You could also just... you could, for instance, make a DNA ring.
Yes.
And you will find the same rules. And this is just done this year. People have done this experiment. They redid this this work with a selection of good sequences for nucleosomes and did the same work now for the propensity of DNA to form rings. And they recover the same rules. It's a paper where John is again a co-author. He still pops up in many papers. Okay. So yes, you can multiplex these two together. Now, I want to ask a new question. How does it actually work? What is the underlying mechanisms that allow for the multiplexing of these two types of information? And here is one of the reasons why it's good that these talks are recorded, because John Widom, just shortly before he died, gave a talk here at the KITP, just in the next room. I think it's here. And it's recorded, so I just listened to it again, and then I checked his ideas that he just speculated. So he speculated there are three reasons that allow for the multiplexing between these two types of information. One is the obvious one that I just discussed, that protein sequences are highly degenerate. That is one reason that you need. This gives you the wiggle room. But two other claims are it's also possible just because no genomes are selected for highest affinity to nucleosomes. There are never any very strong positioned nucleosomes. Otherwise, he claims multiplexing wouldn't work. And the third claim was it has something to do with how the nucleosome feels or reads out the mechanical properties of the DNA molecule. So he gave these three reasons. And so we could now simply check whether he was right with his speculations using our model. The first one I don't have to discuss. It's the degeneracy of the genetic code. The second one is that when you look at the positioning of nucleosomes on genomes, you never find a nucleosome that's extremely strongly selected for highest affinity.
So is there evidence of multiplexing happening in evolution, like them being repositioned if you look at different groups?
This is exactly the question I'm excited about and okay. hope to see. I think I see already something. I will not speak about this today, but I can discuss with you in private. By looking at whole genomes, I believe I see some signs that exactly this has happened. But it's very indirect evidence at this point. So there's still a lot of work to have to be done. So all we did is we simply created a very strong positioning sequence, the strongest which we could, essentially, by going to very low temperatures. This is a very happy nucleosome, or a very happy sequence. And then we just move our nucleosome along that DNA molecule, and you can see how much the energy shoots up. So now we go from 40 to 90. This is the most extreme I can achieve, essentially. I don't know if it's realistic, but that's what our model gives us. And now the idea is to put ourselves on the top of this barrier where the nucleus, where the DNA is extremely unhappy to bend, and ask ourselves, could we again, through synonymous mutations, create a minimum at this place? In order to do so, we have, of course, to assign a codon sequence to my fantasy DNA sequence, and there are three different codon frames you could choose when you assume that you transcribe from left to right. And for all three codon frames, we try to create a minimum, but we still have a maximum. So we cannot shift a super strong positioned nucleosome along if it would exist. Third reason is a bit even more complex to understand. John claimed that there's a certain plasticity in the way DNA reads out, or the nucleosome reads out the DNA mechanics, because maybe when you multiplex the two types of informations, a good step, a soft step like a TA, cannot be there. But maybe it can still be one to the left or one to the right. And there it's still nearly as good in doing its job as it were in the most optimal position. And we can just check if that happens in our simulation. So here's just an example where we shifted the original nucleosome by 5 base pairs to this new position. And when you then look at details of how we achieve this, you can see that such things happen. So for instance, if we focus on these steps here, what likes to be there is an AATT or TA. But in this concrete case, where we encode for a gene, where we encode for a protein, this step is the beginning of the codon ACT that stands for 309, and all codons of 309 start with AC. So this is locked to BAC. It cannot become AATT or TA. But at the position before, the codon before glutamic acid, we have two possible options. And one of them would bring an A step just one position to the left of where it wants to be. And that is what really happens in we created a huge sample of such sequences. And in most of them, it will choose the GAA version, bring an AA just next to the position. And I find this really remarkable because John came up with these ideas just by thinking. He had no way to prove them, and we can test them with our model. So what I'm in time, it's 50, okay. So I want to go now a step deeper in something like evolution with an additional question I want to ask, and that is, can this kind of DNA mechanics actually be used for more than just positioning nucleosomes? And I want still to ask that in the context of nucleosomes, can I do something more exciting than just position nucleosomes? And I believe, yes, I can. Think about our sequence space again. I have this great rocket, but I flew just to one corner of my Milky Way. Couldn't be there a lot of exciting things out there? I believe there are, and the way I'd like to see this is that this space actually contains many different nucleosomes with very exotic mechanical properties, sort of different nucleosome phenotypes. And so in that sense, this Milky Way would then contain all different possible, just 147 base pair long nucleosomal genomes. And in that sense, I would have a very direct connection between a genotype and a phenotype. There's no embryonic development in between or anything like this. I can just directly connect them. But then the question is, can I find these things, or is this just fantasy? I could fly to the high affinity nucleosomes, but could I fly to any other phenotype? Could I create them and fly to them? And I believe I can. And I will give you one example now, a first example of creating a very exotic nucleosome. Later, of course, the hope is to see whether such nucleosomes exist with certain functional roles inside real genomes. So for this, I have to give you a little bit background. I want to look at a nucleosome that behaves funny when you pull on it. Many people have pulled on nucleosomes because people think it's interesting to learn about the interaction between the DNA and the octamer by doing this, because people can do it with micromanipulation experiments. And people do it also because one believes that nucleosome gets under tension inside the cell, for instance, when a transcribing RNA polymerase collides with a nucleosome. The first experiment was performed by the group of Michel Wang at Cornell University. They managed to put 70 nucleosomes on a piece of DNA and pull on it with an optical tweezer. And they measured the force as a function of the extension when they increased this array of nucleosomes. And they saw that the force rises, and then there are 17 drops, which corresponds to the unwrapping of the last turn of the 17 nucleosomes. And what's remarkable here is that this happens sequentially, not in parallel, that the forces at which the nucleosomes break are much higher than what we would expect based on equilibrium experiments and different types of experiments which were done before, and that actually the force at which they break depends with the pulling rate. The faster you pull, the higher the force. And the explanation by the experimentalists was that there is a barrier between the wrapped state and the unwrapped state. And by applying a force and tilting the energy landscape, you can learn about the nature or the height of this barrier and so forth. So they wanted to determine this barrier. And when they did this, they found a very big barrier, about 35 kBT, between the wrapped and the unwrapped state. And the interpretation of this finding is that there are two very strong binding sites that just hold one turn of DNA in position. But honestly, looking at the crystal structure, I don't see such strong binding sites. And this energy is much too big on the total scale even, of the total adsorption energy of a nucleosome. So that doesn't make much sense. Back then, this was already in 2004, a PhD student of mine, Igor Kulich, came up with a very simple explanation. This is our nucleosome model. Now, there's no sequence dependence. And so everything can be calculated analytically. So we just model the DNA like an elastic rod like this. So we sequence dependence is averaged out if you want so. It's absorbed on the surface of the cylinder and a force is applied to it. And the energy of this has just three contributions. This one here is the bending energy. You just integrate along the contour of the DNA molecule over the curvature squared, where A is the bending modulus, which gives the stiffness of the DNA molecule. Then there's a force times end-to-end distance, and the part that is absorbed gains something. So if you unwrap, which means you increase this angle alpha, you pay a price. The energy goes up. There's a second angle that describes the geometry of this problem, beta, which is the tilt of the superhelical axis of the nucleosome with respect to the z-axis. Now, astonishingly, this can be worked out using 18th century physics, nothing else. You just use results from Euler from 1744, and it turns out that this particular curve here that Euler drew happens to be part of these DNA arms. That's just the right form. So this is actually work on the shapes of elastic rods under tension or compression. So this can all be worked out. I don't show you the final formula, but I show you the energy landscape. So the nucleosome under a force actually is, so I have to say what this is. So this is the energy of this structure as a function of the unwrapping angle. That is a single turn wrapped, completely unwrapped, and the flipping angle, the second angle beta. This is already very high force. The totally unwrapped nucleosome is the global minimum, but the system is typically stuck here in a very deep metastable state, a singly wrapped nucleosome, a huge barrier in between. And during unwrapping, the spool makes a flip 180 degrees. As you can see, this blue cylinder makes a flip. And at the top of the barrier, the transition state, where does this energy comes from that makes the nucleosome so stable against the force? So it turns out that most of the energy is in this strongly bent portion where the DNA has to make a 90 degrees turn to enter into the wrapped portion. The length of this bent piece scales like the square root of the stiffness divided by the force. So the sharper you pull, the harder you pull, the sharper the bend. And then you can calculate the energy, and it just scales like the square root of the bending modulus times the force. So the barrier isn't there in the experiment. The experimentalists wanted to measure a barrier, but there was no barrier. They created the barrier when they pulled on it. So that's kind of ironic. The beautiful thing about this is that you could say that the nucleosome is protected against tension by building up a barrier, and so that it doesn't fall off when there's a transient tension on the nucleosome. And this, yeah?
Does this take into account supercoiling?
It does not take into supercoiling, and that on purpose, because in the experiment, they have freely rotating ends. With supercoiling, you can use a variant of this theory, but it's much more messy to understand what's going on. It's kind of interesting that this kind of, or not surprising maybe, that this force-induced strengthening that is used by the nucleosome is of course also used a lot in engineering. This is an early example. Leonardo da Vinci was interested to build lifting tongs with which you could build very heavy stones and bring very heavy stones up to the top of a cathedral. And this is constructed in such a way that the greater the weight held by this lifting tongue, the better and stronger it will be supported. Now, how did this theory hold up through the years? It held up very nicely. There are now new experiments that use that sequence here, the 601 sequence of Widom, because that allows experimentalists to much better control the system and just to pull on a single nucleosome. First such experiment was performed by Bustamante's group, and they found, in fact, when they look at, so they pull here on a single nucleosome, and they find two such transitions, two flipping transitions, one from 2 to 1 turns, which we hadn't thought would happen, and one from 1 to 0 turns, the one which we had predicted. But this year, the detail of understanding has increased a lot by experiment by Tekip Haas group at Urbana-Champaign. They pulled on the same nucleosome, the 601 nucleosome, but they could actually follow the unwrapping of the nucleosome. They could figure out how it actually unwraps, and it unwraps asymmetrically. They put little fret labels at various positions on the nucleosome. So in one experiment, they would have one fret label. If the DNA is closed like this, you shine in green light, there's a fluorescence energy transfer. Out comes red light. If the DNA is unwrapped, you shine in the light, green light, and green light comes out. So when you look at this particular location, ED1, and you look at how it looks like the fret efficiency as you increase the force, very early on, before 5 piconewton, this has unwrapped. If you look at the other end, this one here, it stays closed up to about 15 piconewton, and then only it unwraps. So it's highly asymmetric. So we can easily check this with our model. We simply attach some extra DNA here to have nice arms to pull on, and then we release some of these constraints. We open the binding sites and just look at the energies of the different states. When we do this, we find an energy landscape that looks very similar to the theoretical one, but it's a slightly different plot. I show here the number of sites unbound from the right, and the number of sites unbound from the left. And you see there's a metastable state, a high barrier, and then the global minimum. So this is the fully wrapped state, which is not very likely to occur. This is the global minimum, the completely unwrapped state. This is the half-flipped nucleosome, this high-energy transition state. And what I believe, what is seen in the experiment, is a metastable state. They are somewhere here in the valley. The nucleosome is stuck in here, and they look at the fret efficiency in this case. And that would be when you have just one turn of DNA wrapped around the cylinder. So what we have to look at is simply the energy along this valley. We just have to go along this valley and measure the energies. And when we do this, then we find that here is by far the lowest energy, a very asymmetric state, which exactly corresponds to the FRET signal. So here we seem to be in agreement with the experiment. There's also here a state, but it's already 3 kT higher. But the barrier here in between is still much lower than the barrier that is from the flipping transition to the unwrapped state. The experiment was also done with a variant of the sequence where the inner 2 quarters were flipped, and they found that the nucleosome then unwraps from the other side. And so this is this new sequence that has a flipped inner part, and our energy indeed also has now the minimum on the other side. And they started from the original sequence and made it a bit more symmetric by putting a couple of soft TA steps at strategic positions. And they found then that the nucleosome unwraps symmetrically either from the left or from the right. And this is also to quite some extent what we see in our model. Why does it happen? Why do these different behaviors happen? It's actually very surprising. I was very confused from this experiment because the outer ends are identical, right? They don't change in the different experiments. And when you unwrap either from the left or from the right, it should not make any difference. And there should not be any differences between these curves. But if you look more carefully, it turns out when you unwrap, for instance, from the left, you unwrap 10 base pairs beyond. So you see these differences here. And likewise, when you unwrap from the right.
So is this entire sequence in contact with the nucleosome?
This is the entire sequence that is in contact with the nucleosome, yes. And then outside there's much more DNA creating the arms. But when the DNA is now in this metastable unwrapped state, it's only this part that is in contact, and this part is already unwrapped. And so these are the different ways this can be unwrapped. So it turns out that just this little piece here makes all the difference between these different cases. So having enough confidence in our model, we can now create, this is just one more slide, I think. We can create now our nucleosomal phenotype and fly to it. I want to create a nucleosome that has very funny behavior when you pull on it. But otherwise, it's a well-behaved nucleosome, well-positioned, everything else. So what I have to do is I have to get rid of this barrier. I have to cut a deep trench into the barrier or a tunnel that I just immediately unwrap as soon as you pull on the nucleosome. That's what I want to see if I can create. And so we could actually also maybe say where it unwraps, if it unwraps here asymmetrically or through the middle. We won't even control that. How can we do this? We have somehow to play with this energy landscape here along the ridge. And we have to dig a very deep minimum somewhere. Let's say we want to make a symmetric unwrapping. So here right in the middle, we want to dig very deep into the barrier. Now we use our rocket as a shovel to make a deep minimum here. How do we do this? It's very simple. We simply hold the nucleosome in this configuration. So we simply hold it in this configuration here. We keep the binding sites fixed such that it's at that particular place, and we perform mutation Monte Carlo. And then automatically, a nucleosome will pop up that doesn't have too much energy in these strongly bent portions. But at the same time, it turns out the nucleosome will also be very well positioned because we also make mutation Monte Carlo in the wrapped portion. So here, this is now the energy landscape going along the ridge, and you can see here, where we wanted to have a big minimum, we have a big minimum, about 20 kT deep ditch inside the barrier. If we go to another place, let's say here, we can also do the same thing. We hold the nucleosome now asymmetrically, do our mutation Monte Carlo, get a deep ditch here. Okay, so this is the first example of, I think, many possible examples of funny nucleosomes that you could create this way. Yes?
When you do that, you don't modify the structure, the shape on the side?
So in our...
mutated, so I guess the whole curve should be...
Yes, so because I'm not only mutating the sequence, I'm also doing the conformational moves, it will do everything at the same time automatically. So you can imagine that in the beginning, when I start with some random sequence, or 601 or whatever sequence, it's a very stiff nucleus, so it will therefore be less sharply bent. Then I start to make it softer around here by choosing the right sequences, and it will automatically start to be sharper bent. This goes all hand in hand automatically. So to summarize, I showed you that this mechanical information can be used to position nucleosomes or to create various nucleosome phenotypes. Also, I showed you that this mechanical and genetic information can be multiplexed. We haven't done yet nucleosome phenotypes on top of genes where we can only make synonymous mutations, but that will be done in the future. And where do I want to go from there? There are tons of possible directions. The first one is how, just what I just spoke about, you can create all kinds of funny nucleosome phenotypes, for instance, phenotypes that that can store twist over or under twist. And we can then check if they also exist in real genomes and have specific functions. Or what we can do is we can actually simulate some kind of mechanical evolution along a DNA molecule. We have now a new method that is very fast that allows us to do that. And we can then compare the statistical properties of the energy landscape that we can create this way to the statistical features that are observed for real genomes. The third one is maybe when we understand these things well enough, we can see some kind of signatures of higher order structures beyond the nucleosome and can also contribute to this. What I haven't shown you today, and that's a really difficult part, I'm working on that, is that anything like this has happened. I mean, you asked that before. Are nucleosomes really shifted on top of genomes? Is this mechanical evolution really taking place? I believe it is on a large scale, but this would take another talk, and I'm still not very clear about it. But this is really an open issue. It could, just to tell you the most negative scenario that could happen, DNA evolves just like, doesn't care about the mechanics, it just evolves. And then the nucleosomes just find positions where they're happy. They were not created these nucleosome positions for them, they just happen to be there. And the nucleosomes go there. And the experimentalists come, map the nucleosomes, and find nucleosomes that are in happy positions. And they find all these funny rules. But it has nothing to do with an evolution. That's a distinct possibility.
That would be very odd, given that when you look at transcription start sites in yeast.
Yes, so that's an example.
Every gene has no nucleosome there, like every gene.
Yeah, so, but...
But those are being kicked off actively, I think, aren't they?
No.
No.
You can do that with chicken nucleosomes and yeast DNA in vitro, no ATP.
In vitro, there's no question that there is mechanical information on the DNA molecule, but the question is if it's just at such localized sites, or is it a genome-wide thing that there are many nucleosomes? This is sort of the questions.
Yeah, but I mean, if you get it to be true for 7,000 genes in yeast, I would call that genome-wide. I mean, I understand it's not the whole of the DNA.
So I know about some new work on human DNA, which might be more interesting, and there, I cannot disclose that stuff because it's not my work, it's not published, but there it seems that actually a large fraction of nucleosomes experience mechanical information. So these are people in Lyon that do this work. And so if that's true, then this is really a genome-wide thing. But it's astonishing. I mean, I read a lot John Widom's work. He sidesteps that question to some extent. He doesn't really say much about it. He claims it's the case, but he doesn't show in which way it is the case. I mean, it's true that nucleosomes are positioned, but it's mechanically, that's for sure true, but has it really evolved? Or is it just a random side effect? That is something which really has to be quantified still to quite an extent. It might be a localized effect or might be a genome-wide effect, the sort of the question.
And aren't there situations where even if you have very well-positioned nucleosomes, aren't there things that happen where now the nucleosomes become repositioned in vivo?
Yeah, so there's lots of stuff happening.
Like nucleus on site. So it isn't that you have some DNA every time that there always is a nucleosome at a certain position, but there are alterations that happen where the nucleosomes all sort of shift.
Yeah, so one thing that is, for instance, already quite interesting is on a more global scale. If you look at different tissues, you see that the nucleosome densities are different. That is a beautiful example. And so you cannot think in a simple way about this problem. Like, I think it's much more complex. This landscape might have evolved, but it's not obvious what it's doing at this point, at least to me. I think that there needs a lot of thinking going in there. You can look at particular places where there are indeed switch-like situations where you can go between different states.
What's known about nucleosome-nucleosome interactions, just even just adjacent positions? Like, how much does having a nucleosome at one site influence where the next one, the one next to it, is going to be?
Yeah, I mean, this has a lot to do with higher-order structures, and I've worked on that a lot, actually, in the past. There is a lot of interaction between. I mean, if you just have two nucleosomes that come close to each other, they attract each other. They're the histone tails. So that is an important attraction between them. And then much more easy, maybe much more straightforward, there is a steric effect. I mean, if you start to build a nucleosome and then the DNA comes out in a certain direction, right, and the next nucleosome might, for short linker lengths, not fit at all sterically. So you can work out all the possible configurations of nucleosomes in 3D and which ones are possible and which ones are not. And that would also play an important role in that story.
And I'm just thinking how much the specific sequence of one position is going to matter if there's other higher order things layered onto it.
Yes. So far, people have neglected most of this except the excluded volume. I also didn't speak about this today, but of course, when there's a nucleosome sitting here, I mean, you have a landscape, but now you have to fill the landscape. And once you put a nucleosome, then the next nucleosome doesn't fit. This is an exactly solvable problem. You can actually work this out, and then you get an effective energy landscape of a certain density of nucleosomes. And so you will see that there are essentially two effects. One is the positioning due to the sequence. Another one is a statistical positioning due to the excluded volume. Even if you have a flat energy landscape and you have a wall, then it's like a nucleosome excluding region, for instance, or other protein bound, then the nucleosomes will arrange to some extent ordered. This has already been worked out by Stryer and Kornberg in 1978 or something. So you have several effects, and it's one of the problems in this. The problems here too, where also John was struggling a lot with a lot of critic. What is the fraction of nucleosomes that are actually positioned because of the sequence? And what is the role of other effects? They're chromatin remodelers that move nucleosomes around. It's a mess, of course. Yeah.
I have a question about which one histone. Yeah. Where, I mean, you don't have in your models. Say
yes.
That
could be very easily implemented. Yeah, that's a good idea. I didn't think about this. Yeah, that could be done. That's a nice idea. We can do anything, actually. We can use any kind of piece of DNA. We can make rings, plectonemes, all you want, and we can make sequences that are happy to be in that structure. And yeah, that's a good idea to look at chromatosomes instead of nucleosomes. Thanks.
Related to the previous point and the relationship between the conformation and the sequence. Now, your previous
answer. Yes, okay.
Maybe I missed something, but given the fact that most of the genome is junk, and in human it can be as much as 99, so why would you care about the codon if it does not code properly?
So again, most of it is junk, yes. So again, to this, yes.
Small portion of this.
So you might think that again that all this junk DNA, that the position of nucleosomes on that is not really important.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that the codons that you're looking at just have a small portion of the genome.
Okay. So I wanted just to show that nucleosome positioning could be something that happens on top of genes, not only outside genes. And as I understand, again, this work I don't want to disclose on human genomes show that it happens indeed on both on junk DNA as well as on coding DNA, that there's all kinds of mechanical information sitting in there. And I just wanted to show that you can actually, multiplex. This was such a beautiful idea that John had in this talk that he gave here. And I could easily check this with my model. It took us one afternoon to check all this, and it worked. That's what I found really amazing. Yeah.
I was wondering if you've looked at bacterial DNA. I mean, you don't expect there to be any similar pattern, but maybe there is.
Yeah, so this is also a complex story. I'm a bit interested in this. And I was, for instance, wondering whether supercoils are positioned inside bacteria. So we simulated a plectoneme. So we just rotate, just have some twisted DNA and simulate this. Such a simulation is a nightmare because there's so many conformational degrees of freedom. It's much harder than with the nucleosome. But what we seem to see is that such a structure that is not really strongly bound to something can always rearrange, can retwist or something. And so the effects might be much weaker in that sense in a bacterial genome.
Is there a sequence pattern that is similar?
Yeah, so people have actually looked at whole genomes to see whether there are some periodicities in base pair steps that would indicate this kind of things. And John William did the work in 97, I think on this already, looked at three genomes. And you see, when you look at periodic signals in the genome, you see a very strong signal with a 3 base pair periodicity that comes from the codons. And you see in bacteria and eukaryotic genomes an 11 base pair periodic signal for certain base pair steps, like I think TA. And only for eukaryotes, you find an additional signal with a 10 base pair periodicity. But these are very weak signals. The 10 base pair periodic signal could be something of what I spoke about today, that there are signals that position nucleosomes. The 11 base pair periodic signal could have something to do with supercoiled DNA, which has a different, if you would bend it, a different helical repetition. But also it could have something to do with some periodicities in the protein that is encoded for. So it's a mess. I really don't know what to think about it. But I would really hope that there is something. I think you, Rob, did a lot of work trying to look in bacteria if you see something, right? Some effects, and you didn't see much.
Well, no, I mean, in the context of DNA looping, you see it. I mean, that's something that was seen by Oler and Mueller-Hill very beautifully, and then by Bob Schleif. So you have this really beautiful periodicity.
So you can see something there.
Yeah. As far as HNS and HU and those other proteins, I don't really know about other markers.
Yeah, I would like to speak with you about this, yeah. And then also archaea. So in archaea, you have like a protonucleosome, it's just a tetramer. And there seem to be similar rules at work, like for nucleosomes.
So you said, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the ACPGT sequence is particularly energetically favorable. And I was wondering, well, to what extent do inherent mutational biases change the probability that you'll see these stable states? Because if I'm remembering correctly, I think CPGs tend to be more stable than just GCs.
Yes.
And you also tend to see increased probability of, say, a GC going to an AT. How does this mutational bias interact
with it? So I don't know anything about the subject, to be honest, but I know that is something I have to think about, exactly that. So I will go next year to Lyon, the Ecole Normale, there's people that do this kind of stuff and hope to learn this, because I don't implement it yet, but I think that would be important. Mm-hmm. And I think that these people say that there seems to be in order to keep these kind of rules at work, there needs to be a detailed balance of mutations that makes this possible. Otherwise, it would drift away, and you wouldn't have what you want. So this is indeed something I don't know anything about, but I think it's crucial to learn that. Yeah.
How about the the Central America histones have? Is that all?
I haven't looked at those. I have only looked at telomeres for fun, and they have these short repeats, and so automatically you will have very little. The undulations are very weak, so there's not much positioning going on. If you put a nucleosome on a telomeric DNA, it actually slides along the DNA very quickly, whereas on normal DNA it would be more stuck. But I haven't looked at. There's so many things to look for me as a physicist. Is really so much. Possibilities.
Well, there's an argument a lot of the Central American histones evolved at a very, very high rate.
At what?
Histone broke in eukaryotes in general.
Say again, please. I didn't.
In eukaryotes.
Yeah.
That the Central American histones, you know, most of the histones you're talking about are very, very stable.
Yeah.
It's not true for the Central American histones.
Oh. You mean evolutionary not stable?
Yeah, evolutionary.
Okay, that's interesting. So they seem not to be so crucial in that sense. So.
Well, I don't know if I mean, there are adaptive arguments that we could talk about.
Yeah, I'd love to, yeah.
Okay. One argument is they're under strong selection for certain reasons to change.
Ah, okay. Interesting. I'd love to speak with you about this, yes?
Someone had one more question. What can be said about the very rich sequence, right? So in mitochondria, so in yeast mitochondria, for example, right, it's mostly non-coding. And
but it's no nucleosome.
5% over 85% ATP rich.
Uh-huh.
So I would imagine that would impose a tremendous mechanical constraint.
Yes, you could imagine. But first of all, there are no nucleosomes, I guess, in mitochondria,
no,
right? But other structures.
So the question is, does this in itself imply some sort of structure?
Yeah.
Just making it.
That's interesting. Yeah, we could, for instance, if we would know what kind of conformation the DNA is inside a mitochondria, some kind of supercoil or whatever, we could perform our mutations and see
but
whether.
But that can't go in the opposite direction. I can't just clean with.
No, you can't, sure.
The Talbotian genome has a similar bias AT distribution.
Okay, so we have now a new method. This simulation that I showed you today, where we simulate the whole DNA, would be much too slow to do much of this kind of, to look at whole genomes. But we found now a fast method, it's like a million times faster. We can take any genome and right away get the energy landscape. So we can look at all kinds of genomes. So if you tell me this is an interesting genome, we're happy to look at those things. So please speak to me.
Any other questions for Helmut? Thank you.